The various leaders that we had, they were all controlled by Nigel from behind the scenes until eventually he ran out of people to control because they got fed up with it. It was always the power behind the throne. Anyone that had any ability or seemed to be a threat to him had to be removed. One of the problems we had as spokesman is that he would make policy up on the hoof in front of the microphone. So you'd spend an enormous amount of time working out a policy and then you'd find he'd go on the air and say something completely different. He's always got to be in control. I think he's a control freak. Yeah, you can't have Rupert Lowe going off and saying things in the media and formulating policies which are popular if Nigel was not in control of it. I'm sure that's the reason why he's had to go. All he's ever wanted to be, in my opinion, my estimation, is a Tory. The party was intended to be crashed. It's done its job. It's got the referendum. Now's the time to crash it. You've reached the same conclusion. Catherine Blakelock, I think, reached the same conclusion. I know dozens of people who think exactly the same thing just by observing events, not because they've been persuaded by me or anybody else, but they've watched his performance over the years. They've watched what's happened gradually, and they're watching what's happening now, and they're saying, this is controlled opposition.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the Jolly Heretic. I have a very special guest for you today. In light of all of the internal fighting that is happening with regard to Nigel Farage and Rupert Lowe in the Reform Party, I have with me Mr. Gerard Batten, who was a UK Independence Party member of the European Parliament between 2004 and 2019. During much of this period, of course, Nigel Farage was the leader of the UK Independence Party and who also was leader of the UK Independence Party himself between 2018 and 2019. Gerard, hello.
Hello. Hello there, Ed, and thank you very much for inviting me on.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. So tell me, when this split, or whatever we want to call it, this meltdown started happening in Reform, having known Nigel, of course, and worked with him for a very long time, what kind of thoughts started, what kind of memories, what sort of things started going through your head?
Well, it didn't surprise me in the slightest, Ed, because we'd seen this type of thing many times before over the years in UKIP, right from the start. And don't forget, UKIP goes back to 1993. I don't know, maybe very quickly, just to set the scene, Dr. Alan Sked at the London School of Economics set up the Anti-Federalist League to combat the Maastricht Treaty, the Treaty on European Union. Me and Nigel joined that both at the same time, along with a number of other people, in about March 92. Well, obviously, we needed to change the name. They accepted my suggestion back in September 93 to call it the UK Independence Party. And we went on from there. Nigel had a coup d'etat against Sked in 97 after we had a disastrous election with revelations in the media. And Nigel was forced out. And since then or onwards, Nigel was either controlling the leader and eventually he was forced to become the leader himself. But the various leaders that we had, Michael Holmes, I think, was the first one after Sked, followed by Geoffrey Tipford, then Roger Knapman. They were all controlled by Nigel from behind the scenes until eventually he ran out of people to control because they got fed up with it.
So how did that work? Normally, you would expect the leader of the party to be basically in charge. I know there's variations on that, and one does get puppet leaders. But if that was the case, he was a relatively young man then, Nigel Farage, in his early 40s, was he, or late, something like that, when this was all going on. What was it about him? Why was it that he was able to control these men from behind the scenes and be the de facto but not de jure leader of the party?
Well, he's a very forceful character, you've probably gathered. He's very good with the media. He could bully. I mean, his tactics in dealing people are, you know, either occasionally flattery and cajolement, but very often bullying. He's a very Machiavellian character. And of course, he was very good with the media. So he would be the main spokesman for the party because no disrespect to those gentlemen, they weren't all terrific on the media. So Nigel would do that. And he would make up policies on the hoof or whatever they find out afterwards. He was also very good at controlling the National Executive Committee. You know, I've watched him in that over the years because I was on that in different capacities at different times for quite a long period of time. And he was very good at controlling them. So he had the effective control of the party and these people weren't strong enough and they didn't have the abilities to stand up for him. So he basically ran the party anyway. He was always the power behind the throne.
So why wasn't he just the leader then?
I think he didn't want to be at a certain point up until, I can't remember when the year when he first became leader, but I think he preferred not to be and just work from behind the scenes. Well, he very much in front of the scenes, to be honest, but he didn't actually want the job of leadership. Eventually he was forced into it, I think. That's my view and my perspective.
Do you think it's that he doesn't like the organisation involved? He doesn't like that element of it?
I'm sure he doesn't. No, and I mean, it's especially for a small party, it's a nightmare because you have problems in raising money, recruiting members, actually overseeing the branch organisation. I mean, don't forget the big parties have people to do that for them. They have money and they have organisations to do that for them, and the leader can concentrate on politics. Not possible in the small party. The leader has a tremendous amount of work to do that he shouldn't really be doing, but forced into it.
Right. And so when you say that he was bullying people and cajoling people to get what he wanted, can you give me examples of what form that kind of took?
I can't give you a specific one, but I mean, you know, he would come to an NEC meeting and he would tell them something very forcefully that something was true and force them into a course of action or some decisions. And then afterwards you find out, well, it wasn't quite the way he described it or wasn't even true. But by then the decisions had been taken, they were in the open and there was nothing anybody could do about it. I saw that on many occasions. And he would get things turned around. For example, I remember on one occasion we had a review of our constitution, because we had a constitution right from the start, right from the earliest days. And in that constitution, one of the provisions was that we were committed to free trade. And at an NEC meeting where this review was going on, I said, well, you can't have that in a constitution because it's not a principle, it's a policy. Now, it may well be great and you may want to do it, but it's not a principle that you have in a constitution. So they said, OK, we'll take it out. At the next NEC meeting, which I wasn't at, I then found out that he turned up and he's a big in favour of free trade. And he got it put back in. So he was able to get these people to change their decision from one month to the next quite easily. And I did that on numerous occasions with different things.
And why was
carry on.
Well, why was it then that nobody stood up to him? Is it because at that stage there wasn't enough talent in the party, or because it was a small party, or what was it that was why
you got chopped down if you did that, and then people were gotten rid of. Now, to be fair to Nigel, there were some people throughout the years who needed to be gotten rid of. Every party leader has the same problem. You have people who are just a problem and they need to go. But anyone that had any ability or seemed to be a threat to him had to be removed. They had to be forced out. And we had this with loads of people throughout the years, because I think even people who weren't a threat, if he perceives them that way, then something has to be done about them. I was surprised that I survived as long as I did in UKIP. And I think the reason I was able to do that was because I had a lot of following amongst the ordinary members and the branches. I made a point of visiting the branches, talking to them, and also providing ammunition for them. Because one thing they were all short of were actually policies and arguments. And I did an enormous amount of work on security and defence. I was a spokesman for that for about 5 years. Home affairs and immigration, law and order, I was a spokesman on that. And then I kind of self-appointed myself as the Brexit spokesman. And I did an enormous amount of work, which I disseminated out to the branches. And they appreciated that because soldiers in the front line need ammunition and they weren't getting it from the centre. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was quite popular. And I think when he got rid of Godfrey Bloom, now, when was that? That was 2014, I think. It wasn't just prior to that. Then I think he would have liked to have gotten rid of me, but it was probably considered politic not to, but to leave me there, because getting rid of Godfrey and me at the same time, we were, you know, a couple of the most popular MEPs that the party had amongst the rank and file.
Yes, I interviewed Godfrey, of course, about this, and he made a similar point that Nigel, the problem is that the metaphor he used was it's like leading an army. And if you lead an army, or indeed any organization, on the one hand, you've got people that are up and coming and trying to get your job. But on the other hand, those are the people that are going to be talented and who will be able to take your job if, you know, you get shot, as it were. You know, this is the quality captain that can replace the major when the major is leading the men into battle at the Somme or something and gets shot. So it seems to me basic leadership that you have to be able to strike that balance somehow, whatever combination of inducements, of rewards, of threat, whatever, but you have to strike that balance to keep those people on board. And you give me the impression that he seems very bad at striking that balance.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've met very few people throughout my long career before I joined UKIP and in UKIP who I would describe as leaders. But it seems to me they've got certain characteristics. One is they're very good at what they do, and they, by and large, can do what they're asking their subordinates to do. And number two is that they're not frightened of the subordinates precisely because they want to nurture talent underneath them. And number three, they will defend their subordinates if they get into legitimate problems. And I think they're the three key things in leadership. Well, Nigel is very good at what he does, excellent at what he does, and I can say a bit more about that if you want. But he doesn't nurture people underneath him because I think he feels threatened by them. And he doesn't defend people if and when this occasion arises when they legitimately need to be defended.
Yeah, so let's go into that before we go back into the flaws. Because a lot of people have interviewed, they're saying, a lot of people online now are saying very negative things about Farage, but yet he's achieved quite a lot. So what would you say are his key qualities?
He's a fantastic campaigner, and he was from the start. He's a very good debater. He's got a terrific memory for facts and figures and arguments, and you can see it at work. And I've often watched him, and I thought, well, you know, I know quite a lot, but I couldn't do what he does. And you would have seen this in the referendum campaign. He was the best spokesman on the Leave side. He wiped the floor with Nick Clegg, if you remember that Channel 4, I think it was on Channel 4 debate. David Cameron refused to go on with him because he knew he'd get beaten because David Cameron didn't have a legitimate argument for staying inside the European Union. And Nigel was in command of all the facts. So he's very good at that. He was also quite good at getting money out of rich people because every party needs donors. And he was also very good at spending it, not always wisely, but that's another story. But he was quite good at fundraising. And of course, when he goes on the TV and he gives a very convincing message, it's good at bringing in new members. So there is positives. It used to be said about him by different people in the party that he was the best salesman in the organisation, but that doesn't make him MD material. You don't make the best salesman in a company the managing director, or sometimes it happens and it's not always a success because they're too different talents. The MD has to be very effective. They also have to be diplomatic. And that isn't necessarily what a prime salesman does. He focuses very much on bringing in the next sale.
When you were leader of UKIP, you did something which I regarded, which some would say was quite brave, or some would say, I don't know, some would criticise it, but certainly some would say it was brave, which is that you tried to open up the tent of UKIP to other popular right-wing influencers, shall we put it like that?
First of all, I'm not keen on the right wing because I don't regard myself as right wing, or I don't regard what we stand for as right wing. I think these terms are a bit out of date now in the modern world. But you're quite right, because I wanted UKIP to be a genuinely populist party, which seems to me quite logical that a political party wants to be popular with the voters. Why have we got all the problems we've got across Europe? And had in the US until recently, it's because the government's policies are not popular because they're not helping the people who elect them and who they're governing. Now, right from the start in 93, it was intended that UKIP would have a full manifesto of policies. And we did, and probably got it stored somewhere in my archive. But we had a full a manifesto of policies because when we sat in that room in the London School of Economics and formed the party, we weren't under the delusion that we were going to form the next government at the next election. Our objective was to become a force in national politics, and at that point to persuade either the Labour Party or the Conservative Party to change their policy on the European Union by means of the electoral threat that we posed, which eventually, of course, that's how we got the referendum. And that was the objective. But we also knew that a one-issue party was not going to get votes. Now, okay, you could, as we proved, do that in the European elections, but that's because people were voting for or against the European Union in European elections. That's what they tend to do. Well, there's a tribal vote plus how people feel about the EU. So we knew we had to develop policies. He was never keen on policies. Now, I think 2015, when we did very well, we got about 12%, 12.9%, I think, of the national vote. We did have quite an extensive manifesto, which he didn't devise. That was, I think, Diane James had a lot to do with that, along with somebody who was very good at writing policy. In fact, I think it was a bit too detailed, because my view on policy is you try to keep it as much about principle as about specifics, because if you did become the government, you know, things change from day to day. So really, you should be following a set of principles rather than specific policy, although, of course, you will have specific policies that you're going to adhere to. He's never keen on that. He would much rather not have policies. And one of the problems we had as spokesman, and I can tell you an amusing story about that, is that he would make policy up on the hoof in front of the microphone. So you'd spend an enormous amount of time working out policy, and then you'd find he'd go on the air and say something completely different. And in fact, how I became, well, I was appointed security and defence by Roger Natman when he was leader, and then I did justice and home affairs. And then Nigel fully became leader. I was called up by one of the press officers, Mark Croucher, and said, "Do you want to be the spokesman on immigration?" I said, "Yeah, I've done a load of work on this. I know quite a bit about it." And he said, "Well, I'm making you the spokesman." I said, "How's that work?" He said, "Well, I'm sick and tired of the press ringing me up, asking me who the spokesmen are. We haven't got any. So I'm going to appoint somebody." So me and I think a few others were appointed spokesman by the press officer, because Nigel just didn't want to do it. And I went on in that vein for up until 2014, I think, when we were re-elected. And after that, I didn't really have a spokesman role, but I made myself the Brexit spokesman and became quite an authority on that. And I published two books on the subject. Because, again, you see, now, when we talked right from the start about leaving the EU, and I've always said, well, how are you going to do it? You can't just say we're going to leave. You have to have a set of policies and ideas of how you make it work. And I was adamant from the start that it should be, as the Labour Party was up until 1983, I think, was it, or 3 or 7? That you could only leave by means of unilateral and unconditional withdrawal. Because what Nigel used to say going around talking to meetings was, oh, it's got to be an amicable divorce. Well, I used to say, well, why would they allow you an amicable divorce when they don't want to be divorced from you? So it's, you're going to have to take the initiative and say, we've left and this is how it's going to work. And I wrote, as I said, I wrote two books on the subject. I wrote in 2017, when Paul Nuttall became leader, he made me the Brexit spokesman, and I wrote a detailed plan on it. But you could never get Nigel to adhere to this. It was all vague about how we were going to leave. And you've seen this ever since. When we did leave the European Union, nobody had a plan for how to make it work. And Mrs. May, of course, didn't want to make it work. Boris didn't want to make it work, which is why you've ended up in this not really left situation that we're in now, where we're still saddled with lots of EU law. We still pay them loads of money. I'm not up to date on the latest figures, and where our armed forces are being subsumed into the European Defence Force, which, if they get their way, looks like it'll take us into war with Russia, by what they're saying at the moment. So my view was, you have to have a very firm policy on that, but you also have to have populist policies. And this is, again, one of the main reasons that people voted to leave the European Union isn't because they sat down and studied the facts and figures about the economic costs, the financial costs, and also the democratic cost. I think what brought it home to people was the massive immigration that they were experiencing, and that they were effect that they was having out on their lives and their employment prospects, etc. This is what swayed them and made them vote to leave. Not everybody. I mean, you know, some people like me have always been opposed to our membership of the European Union. There was a lot of those about. So I think that was a key factor, but it always was. I mean, in 2004, if you remember that, Ed, when we had Kilroy Silk, Robert Kilroy Silk. Nigel recruited him, and this is another common pattern. He would recruit people because they could bump the votes up.
Yeah, I remember that. It was a very kind of, because you were up against the BNP, who didn't win a seat in that election because they basically, they brought in all postal voting in areas where the BNP might win, and they tried to sort of rig it, and which they did. So they won in 2009. And you were quite politically correct. You would be the, I think you had, what was that TD cook from the 80s, that black woman? I can't remember her name.
Oh, yeah, Rusty Lee.
Rusty Lee. And she was a candidate. And I just thought, I remember thinking, I was a postgraduate at the time, I was 23. I remember thinking, God, this is getting silly. And yeah, you brought in Kilroy Silk. And I remember saying at the time, this hasn't worked in the past. So True Finns, the Finnish sort of nationalist, whatever, populist party, they brought in a guy, they'd earlier brought in a guy called Tony Halme. And he'd been elected a member of parliament. And it was disastrous, of course. And he fell out with the leadership and he wanted to be in charge and all this kind of thing. And then you had the Pim Fortuyn, who was this in Holland, of course, who was this celebrity. He was well-known newspaper writer, or whatever, celebrity academic in the Netherlands, sets up his own political party, gets himself shot or gets shot. And then the party, the Pim Fortuyn party, is just a bunch of, it totally falls apart, completely useless. I remember thinking at the time, this doesn't bode well. Kilroy Silk, he used to be a Labour MP. He writes outrageous things in the newspapers. Well, I'm not sure about this, but they got him in. But anyway, yeah, carry on. Yes, 04. Get him in.
I never have any time. I'm extremely disorganised. Things basically overwhelm me. I don't know why this is. It's probably some sort of genetic thing. I'm basically present-oriented, a fast life history strategist. I really should find out more. And in order to do so, I should probably read this book, Blueprint, by Robert Plomin. It's a fantastic book, and it looks at the genetics of our psychology, the genetic reasons why we have the kind of personalities we have, why we have the kind of intelligence we have. Maybe that would help me make sense of why I'm like I am. I should read that book. But the problem is, as we've established, I never have any time. So I don't really see how I can read it. Or so I thought, until I discovered Legion.com. What Legion.com does is it takes the most basic and interesting books, including Blueprint by Robert Plomin, and it summarises them into just 25 minutes, and then it allows you to listen to those books. That's my problem solved. Legion.com. And if you sign up today with the code TJH, then you will get 10% off. Legion.com. All the base knowledge from your phone straight into your brains.
The reason that he brought in a lot of votes is because he had this very long program on the TV, on BBC, I think. In fact, I was in the audience on one occasion. And he was very good because what he would do, he would allow the audience members to have their say. He might do something on crime or a current or immigration or the EU. And the one I was on there was actually about the EU. And he would allow the audience to have their say. And he was very good at what he did. Nigel recruited him, because none of the rest of us knew this was happening, because we only found out anything after the event, and that was true for the whole of your time in UKIP. He'd never discussed anything with the MPs or the NEC. He just did things. So he brought Kilroy Silk on. I felt personally that transformed my chances of winning in London. I thought I was 60-40 going to lose. The minute that Kilroy Silk came in, I thought, the odds have changed. It's now 60-40 in my favour. And I got elected in London because one of the most important things in politics is being known. Doesn't matter whether people hate you, so long as they know you, you've got no chance of being elected if they don't know who you are. So you'll have a lot of people don't like you. You'll have a lot of people that do like you. But if they don't know who you are, you've got no chance at all. So he was, in a way, he was correct to bring in Kilroy Silk. The problem is he didn't, I think, understand what he was contending with. Kilroy Silk came in. And he had very firm ideas. We sat down at the first NEC meeting and Kilroy Silk said, well, you've won now. You're on the crest of a wave. You've got to appoint 10 spokesmen on key major topics, you know, the economy, farming and fishing, immigration, whatever. And you've got to go strong on immigration because the numbers then were pretty high. Even so, even 20, 25 years ago, the numbers were pretty big. And Nigel, well, we don't want to do that. And Roger Natman, oh, no, we'll get called racist. You can't do that. And I thought, well, Kilroy's speaking my language. I know we're not going to get anywhere unless we exploit this opportunity and actually have populist policies. So Kilroy Silk got pretty fed up pretty quick about not going anywhere and then launched his own bid for leadership. But the trouble was he was a bit of an egomaniac. He didn't listen to advice. And he then went off and formed his own party, Veritas, which Mark Croucher redubbed Vanitas, and got absolutely nowhere.
Yeah, of course.
It was a common thing that he'd bring people in because they could be, you know, make us popular at a particular time. He had another lady called Marta Andreasen, who was one of our MEPs. Now, you may not remember, she's not a household name now, but she had a big to-do with the European Union. I think she was an accountant, and I think she was an auditor. I'm not sure. And she walked out because, or she was fired, because she wouldn't sign off the accounts. I can't remember the exact story, but anyway, it was along those lines. And she was very much against EU fraud. Nigel brought her in as an MEP. She was in the press. I'm sure she helped get more votes in election, and then didn't take very long. Then she fell out with Nigel as well and had to go. And in fact, I can't remember which term it was, because I was there for three terms. It might have been the middle term. By the time we were getting towards the end, we'd lost 45% of the MEPs who'd left for various reasons and left the party. I used to joke that it could end up, if it went on much longer like this, it could end up that it will be just me and Nigel left in the party.
Right, but he continuously falls out with people who show any kind of. I mean, what is that in his character? Why?
I think he needs control. He's always got to be in control. And as we discussed earlier, if you're a leader, you've got to trust your subordinates. You give them a plan and you trust them to carry it out. And you've got to give them a bit of leeway. And I think he can't do that. I think he's a control freak. And you're seeing this now in reform. He couldn't have, I've forgotten his name now. Sorry, it's gone out of my head. Rupert Lowe, I'm sorry. Yeah, you can't have Rupert Lowe going off and saying things in the media and formulating policies which are popular if Nigel was not in control of it. I'm sure that's the reason why he's had to go. And Nigel doesn't like to be too controversial either. Now, I saw an interesting thing this morning, Ed. Gawain Toler, his very long and loyal press officer, who was gotten rid of a little while ago, and I got on quite well with Gawain. In fact, he was my part-time press officer when I became leader, because I couldn't afford a full-time one. Gawain was saying on a tweet that Nigel doesn't ride the crest of a wave. He comes in after.
I've written this down, and you mentioned this with regard to Kilroy Silk. Kilroy Silk, literally, you quoted him as using this term wave. And I was going to ask you about that. Kind of how brave is Nigel Farage? Because it strikes me that with regard to things like immigration, you have essentially the British National Party and those kinds of people doing the groundwork, getting annihilated, getting their careers ruined, getting prosecuted and put on trial, all that kind of stuff. They're the ones that are riding the crest of the wave. And then once that's kind of rendered discussing the idea that multicultural society, because you've got to remember in 2004, people were still like, oh, multiculturalism is great. They do the groundwork, they get buggered, and then he comes in a bit behind and tries to take all the glory.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair to him, that is true. What you're saying is true. He waits to see when the bandwagon is passing and it's safe to jump on. But he's gone through an enormous amount of persecution just for being, being the anti-EU spokesman and wanting to get us out of the EU. I know for a fact that he's had his car attacked. He's had the family intimidated when he's taken them out for a Sunday lunch. So just on that score, he's had a tremendous amount of persecution.
So he is in
that respect that he's had to put up with that and he's gone on with it.
I don't disagree. He has had. Equally, Douglas Carswell has told me that because of his involvement in the referendum campaign and so on, his daughter was asked to leave her private school.
This is Douglas Carswell.
Douglas Carswell, because the parents, they were rich and thus voted Remain, were so upset that there should be the daughter of this leading Brexiteer at the school. And he had to put his daughter in a different school, young girl.
Nigel doesn't talk about his private affairs much, but he did say once over coffee that he'd had to move his children out of school because they were being bullied by the other kids. And that was a private school, I believe. And so he had to take them, put them somewhere else because of his politics. So he has put up with an enormous lot, and he's brave on that front. And I'll give him his due because it's very unpleasant.
There's a slightly braver thing of the people to the right of him having their houses raided by the police and being put on trial for potential for having 8 years in jail. So it's this, it's this niche. But yes, carry on.
But when it comes to something like this, there are various issues that needed to be called out and said, this is all nonsense. It's not right. I mean, the man-made climate change one, for example, he doesn't really want to engage with that. The Islamic issue, he didn't want to touch. On the, for example, give you an example, on the multiculturalism thing, back in 2006, I wrote an article for a magazine called The Myth of Multiculturalism. Very innocuous argument, I feel, just pointing out it's just a recipe for conflict in the future. And this got into the press somehow, and the BBC wanted me to defend it, but he put another MEP, David Campbell Bannerman, on the Today programme to defend this argument. He wouldn't want me on there to actually talk about my own article because I would have given a vigorous defence of what I'd said in the article, which now, of course, is now common currency, isn't it, Ed? You know, we had Macron, was it Macron or was it Scott Sarkozy? Actually, French presidents actually saying that multiculturalism have failed. I think Mrs. Merkel may have even said it. David Cameron may have said something about it. It's become common currency. But back in 2006, we can't talk about that. We mustn't say it. We must pretend that the problem doesn't exist. And my view on politics, and maybe I'm not a good one to give this view because I failed.
You know, as for the Muslim grooming gangs as well, similar thing. The BNP were talking about that, in 2004, 2005. That there was an undercover documentary, and because of what they said about that, they were put on trial. And then, Nick Griffin was, and Mark Collett, and then he comes. When it's safe to talk about it, it's the same pattern of really kind of cowardice or semi-cowardice, not cowardice, because as you say, he has taken flak. He has, undoubtedly, he has. But it seems to be you and Godfrey and Catherine Blakelock as well highlight this optimum level of bravery, but no further.
I think it's more calculation on what his kind of target audience, the Tories in the shires and the nice, comfortable people that he wants to vote, don't understand it. Because I never came across this in London, so I didn't know about it back then. And I've never had anybody come to me in London when I was a London MEP saying this was a big issue in London. I think it's more an issue in northern towns, or I know it has gone on in other places like Oxford or Bristol, but I've never been aware of it being a big problem in London. And I think he wants to stay away from subjects that he thinks that he's nice Tory audience that he's trying to appeal to would not understand and wouldn't respond to. But the minute it becomes a big issue, that's when he will jump onto the bandwagon as it passes by. And as I was about to say, my view on politics is you should actually lead it rather than wait for it to happen and then try to capitalize on it. Because I think that if politicians are talking about something which may not be in the public consciousness, but they're consistent about it and say, this is what we think, this is what's going to happen, then it's a question of preparation meeting opportunity, because eventually those chickens will come home to roost and people will realise it's a problem. Now, as I said, maybe I'm not the best one to advise on that, since, I took my party to a defeat by trying to talk about things that other people didn't want to talk about. I wrote, for example, back in... 2000, when was the it was 2005, I think, wasn't it? The bombings in London on the buses.
Yes, July 7th, 2005.
And I was the security and defence spokesman. I thought I'd better go and find out what motivates these people. I'd never taken much of an interest in Islam, so I must go and find out. And I went to a meeting in the House of Lords where I was introduced to a former Sharia lawyer who converted to Christianity, who can recite the Quran backwards to you. And he said, it's all in the Quran. The justifications for this are all written down in the Quran or in the Hadith, kill infidels wherever you find them, make war on infidels, strike terror into the hearts of infidels, etc. And I said, well, we can get it written down somewhere in a nice, concise fashion. So he wrote a little booklet for me, which I edited, And I said, well, it's not enough to do this, to tell people. We need to make an issue of it. I said, how about we do a declaration at the back that we ask Muslims to sign, which say, I think there were 5 or 6 key points, like freedom in religion, equality for women, all kind of these completely innocuous things that we would expect people to accept in a Western liberal democracy, and say, let's see how many Muslims we can get to sign up to this and publicise it. So it was all went out on the internet. He had a lot of context, of course. I think we got one Muslim in Australia or something to actually agree to sign it, an imam. And of course, I got slaughtered for this. I was invited on the radio, and all these supposed right wingers like Nick Ferrari and whatever gave me a very hard time because I'd actually put this document out. And of course, Farage would never come in and defend it and say, well, what he said is actually quite true. It's quite, all this stuff is there. This is what motivates these fanatics to do this. And this is a problem that we have to deal with. I mean, as I say, I'm surprised I'm survived as long as I did. He didn't get rid of me because I was insistent on talking about these things.
When I interviewed Catherine Blakelock, she made the very good point that he always seems to leave exactly the point when the party is doing really well and needs to be led further towards power. And there is a number of instances of this. They're on the cusp of a breakthrough almost. For example, doing really, really well at a particular 2009 or whatever it was, European election. And so then he resigns as leader, supposedly to concentrate on fighting Buckingham in the election the following year, which he was never going to win. Then he comes back to being leader, Brexit and so forth. Brilliant. You've got that now. You're winning. You're really getting somewhere. Then he resigns. And now at this point at which they're doing so well, he's really, really ballsed up. And this makes one think that he might be kind of controlled opposition, almost that he's been bought off, almost that this really is some kind of conspiracy. And again, with some other things Catherine said, I really wonder about that. What do you think?
Well, I always thought that he was genuine about getting out of the European Union, because that's how we met in the first place, 33 years ago. He worked extremely hard at that, extremely hard. He made a lot of sacrifices to do that. And I think that that was always genuine. Then we got to the stage of the referendum. And after that, things kind of changed. As you said, he walked away. UKIP at that point was on the crest of a wave because we'd just won the referendum. It was UKIP that won that referendum. It was UKIP that got the referendum because of the electoral threat. And it was really UKIP that won it, boots on the ground, Nigel on the TV, people going out delivering leaflets, holding street stalls and doing that kind of thing. Don't forget, the three main parties were for Remain. Tory party allowed people to campaign for Leave if they wanted to, but there was very few of them, really. There were some key people. I mean, I worked with Andrew Rossendale in Rumford, and I'd run against him in the previous election, but I worked with him to get information out, and we did very well there. It was one of the high-scoring places for Leave. But most Tories either campaigned for Remain or they didn't do anything. Very few proportionally went out and campaigned for Leave. So you had all the main parties, you had all the media, most of the newspapers except for the Express were Remain. You had the international financial institutions like the IMF, the World Bank, etc. And you even had Obama come over and campaign, threaten us in our own country to tell us to remain or we'd be at the back of the queue for a trade deal, etc. And yet, in spite of that, we won, although a narrow margin. I think it was almost 52 to 48. But at that point, I feel the job was done as far as he was concerned, because all he's ever wanted to be, in my opinion, my estimation, is a Tory. He wants the Tory party to go back to being what he thinks the Tory party should be prior to 1972 when Heath took over or revived Mrs. Thatcher's heyday. That's what he wants to be. So he's trying to win the approval of the Tory party, but on his terms, not theirs. So, and then again, these other occasions when he stood down. UKIP was running to the ground. Now who was that? I lose track of the different leaders we had. I think it was Diane James who was leader for about a few days. We used to call her Lady Jane Grey. She was leader for a short time. And he persuaded her to do it. She didn't really want to do it. Then she then walked away. And then, you know, he had to find somebody else to do it. And then eventually we had Henry Bolton. But in the meantime, that opportunity was thrown away because we were very popular. We'd won the referendum. We proved that your vote can make a difference. And that was the time to try and seize on it and,
right. And he did.
win elections. And we didn't. We basically threw it away. And at the same time, I'm saying, well, we've left now, but where's our plan? Why aren't we on TV talking about how it should be done? And eventually we got to this situation. Well, Paul Nuttall became leader, and Paul Nuttall's a very nice chap. But again, I don't think, with all due respect to Paul, he wasn't dynamic enough to make it work. Nigel is, unfortunately. He was the most dynamic one there. And eventually we went, I think we only had a high spot of about 40,000 members, and that was going down all the time under Paul. Not his particular fault, I don't think, because a lot of people felt once the referendum was won, why would they want to continue being a member of UKIP? You know, the impetus had gone. But that was the time to build a new impetus and talk about these other problems that the country faces and the need to do something about it, which, as we're seeing now, has all been proved to be correct and the case. And eventually we got Henry Bolton. Now, to be fair to Henry Bolton, he's a man who can't make a decision. That's one big drawback in politics. But he inherited nothing. He didn't have an office. He didn't have a computer. He didn't have any staff. The HQ was down in Devon, so he couldn't really have an office down there. And as I say, he had this big major problem of not being able to make a decision. One thing, like, the party was intended to be crashed, in my opinion. It's done its job. It's got the referendum. Now's the time to crash it. And we saw, you know, membership going down, money going down. When Henry Bolton became leader in 2018, we had a conference in Torquay. And one of the things on the agenda towards the end of the conference was changing the party logo. Now, you're well aware of the party logo. It's the pound sign with UKIP through the middle. And it had been there for many years. And it was as well known as Coca-Cola and Mars Bar, whether you like it or not. That's how well it was. In fact, we did. I know Nigel consulted some PR people at one point and said, we need to spruce it up. What can we do? And their advice was, well, don't change it, because if you adopt a new logo, it's going to cost you many millions of pounds in advertising to get it anywhere as well known as the logo you've already got. So don't change it. At this conference, the chairman, Steve Crowther, said, well, we're going to change the logo, and the NEC have agreed it. And what he put up on the screen, he got a choice of these two things. He had this thing that looked like a sail of a sailing ship, a yacht, which didn't mean anything to anybody. And we had a lion's head. And you've got a choice, one or the other. Not one or the other, or keep the old one. And, of course, the meeting voted for the lion's head. I went back on the train with Henry Bolton after that, and I said, you've got to change. This is lunacy. You don't change your logo, which is well known to everybody and probably internationally, for something nobody even knows anything about. I said, you've got to get rid of Lenny the Lion. And some of your older viewers may remember Lenny the Lion. You're not old enough, are you? He was a ventriloquist puppet when I was a boy. And I can't remember it. I can't remember who used to work him. But anyway, it was a child.
Yeah, you're literally the same age as my mother. So
anyway, so I said, you've got to get rid of Lenny the Lion. Oh, no, it's a decision of the NEC. So I went back to the office, and I was on Twitter in those days. And I said, Lenny, the lion's got to go. Gawain rang me up and he said, oh, you've got to stop this. Henry Bolton says you've got to stop it. I said, look, this is madness. It's insanity. And I kept on. And then Henry rang me up, and it's the only time I've ever seen him angry. And he was shouting at me down the phone about this. I said, look, you cannot change a well-known party logo for something nobody knows when you're desperately trying to keep your members and your money. And in the end, I go, all right. So I stopped tweeting it. I said, why can't you get rid of it? Oh, because it's a decision of the NEC, and they've made that decision. The minute I was elected, I went to an NEC meeting and I said, Lenny, the lion's going. Yeah, nobody murmured. Now, Steve Crowther, who was the chairman who made this proposal and got them to adopt it, he was supposed to be a marketing expert of some kind. That was supposed to be his background. Well, what kind of marketing expert would say to Mars Bar, well, we're going to call your chocolate bars Venus bars and we're going to put them in a light blue wrapper instead of a dark black one. Oh, yeah, sure, that's a good idea. Watch the sales of Mars bars drop through the floor if you suddenly did that.
Well, yeah, I got very upset when they changed Opal Fruits to Starburst.
And Marathon to Twickers.
Speaking of marketing, though, one of the things that you did when you were leader of UKIP is that you kind of embraced, to some extent, the Tommy Robinson faction. Now, in terms of marketing, some people would argue that because of his association with thuggery and so forth, anything which he touches seems low status. And people will often want to think that they're high status and will want to associate themselves with status. And that perhaps part of UKIP's success was that, unlike the BNP, which was definitely seen as low status and working class, it managed to associate itself with high status, peers of the realm, things like this, and thus people want to be part of it. So isn't that something that Nigel was right about, to keep people like that at arm's length?
If I can explain how this came about, when I took over as leader...
Are you ready for the future of the West?